Etatannam viseshakyam krama vriddhirda sutarai tuya dibbe pare parivrittam pradanena vritirbahi. Oh, two more lines. Yatra loka vitanoyam. They're also there, two more lines there, but he didn't get them. Doesn't matter. Eta etatannam visesakyam krama vridirda sutarai tuyadibi parivrittam pradanena vrittirbahi. Translation. This universal egg, or the universe in the shape of an egg, is called the manifestation of material energy. Its layers of water, air, fire, sky, ego, and mahatattva increase in thickness, one after another. Each layer is 10 times bigger than the previous one, and the final outside layer is covered by pradana. Within this egg is the universal form of Lord Hari, of whose body the 14 planetary systems are part. Purport. This universe, or the universal sky, which we can visualize with its innumerable planets, is shaped like an egg. As an egg is covered by a shell, the universe is also covered by various layers. The first layer is water, the next is fire, then air, then sky, and the ultimate holding crust is pradana. Within this egg-like universe is the universal form of the Lord as the Virat Purusha. All the different planetary systems are parts of his body. This is already explained in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, 2nd Canto. The planetary systems are considered to form different bodily parts of that universal form of the Lord. Persons who cannot directly engage in the worship of the transcendental form of the Lord are advised to think of and worship this universal form. The lowest planetary system, Patala, is considered to be the soul of the Supreme Lord, and the earth is considered to be the belly of the Lord, Brahmaloka, or the highest planetary systems, where Brahma live, is considered to be the head of the Lord. So here's a description of the material universe in quite a scientific manner. In the present state of material advancement, we, by means of our modern scientific equipment, we are not yet able to come to the limit of the universe. As it is, we have Hubble out there, and Hubble is sending us all kinds of information, and it is far out, no doubt, but there is no question that we yet understand the limits of the universe. However, Srimad Bhagavatam gives us a detailed description of the limits of the universe and describes how the universe is egg-like in shape. And it is said that the universe is covered by different shells of energy. And that these energies are like layers covering the universe. And therefore, that it is not possible to just get out of the material universe with these layers, or the shell is actually blocking us from exiting. Then it is also explained in the scriptures that there is not just one universe, but rather that there are unlimited universes that are all together in the same act-formed shape, clustering together, and all existing, again, within a greater area, and which is still material, and beyond that is the spiritual world, the eternal world, which is yet still much greater than the area that is taken up by all the universes together. The spiritual world in itself is unlimited in its nature, and yet it is described to be 3/4 of the total cosmic manifestation. So how could it be, right? Or the Lord if the spiritual energy is unlimited, then sometimes it is described as that the material world is known as the ekapat vibhuti, or one quarter of the total manifestation. So the other three quarters is the spiritual world. Somehow or other, it is like that, and within that three quarters, the spiritual world is unlimited. How that is possible is illustrated in the fact that it is described that when Krishna was in the forest and he was accompanied by calves and cowherd boys, that there were unlimited cowherd boys accompanying Krishna. Right? And how that is possible, we cannot understand. Right? But somehow or other, it was like that. If we try to impose our own mundane conceptions on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then we are doing something that is fundamentally wrong. Because fundamentally, we are not God. So therefore, fundamentally, we do not have the capacity to understand God. And fundamentally, God in capacity exceeds us, just as an ant cannot understand the human situation. It cannot deal with that. It's not possible, right? Because it's another level of experience. It's beyond his capacity. And in the same way, we cannot conceive of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the Supreme Lord can never be known in full. Yet he can be known as much as he reveals himself to us. And that portion that he does reveal, that in itself is wonderful. That is amazing. So this is the understanding of Krishna consciousness. Achinchikalu ye bhavana tamstakini yo jayat. That by dint of logic, one cannot actually figure it out. One can actually not understand. Or by dint of measurement. It is said the Supreme Lord is immeasurable. So here we have a problem, because that's exactly what we're doing. Measuring, right? We're measuring in different ways. We're measuring sound. We're measuring distance. We're measuring our environment. And by comparing it, measuring always means a comparison. If I measure something, I say it's 1 meter, then I compare it to something that has a particular length, which I call 1 meter. So it's a comparison, measuring between two things. And this is relative truth in relation to something else, relative. Is it big or is it small? It's relative. We are big in comparison to ants. We are small in comparison to Mount Everest. What are we? Big or small? Right? It's relative. So everything in the material world is relative according to what the relationship it is perceived in. Right? Good and evil in this material world are relative, according to the relationship it's conceived in. You know, killing is bad, right? One might say, by mundane morality, generally speaking. But what if it is killing to save a life? Right? Is it still bad, or is it good? Right? Now we come at some complexities of ethics here, right? About the relative nature of good and evil. We see that there's a whole discussion amongst Greek philosophers about the relative nature of good and evil, and how Socrates has a whole discussion, and in that discussion, basically, it comes out that what is good and evil, right? What is good for me may be evil for you, and what is good for you may be evil for me, right? So what is good and evil then? How can we determine it? Right? In this world, it is very difficult because everything is relative. It depends on its relationship. In relationship to me, something may be very good, and in relationship to you, it may be bad. Right? So this is the material world. where everything is measured in relationship to something else. But spiritual reality is different. Krishna is the Supreme Lord. He is absolute in nature. Krishna is unlimited. Krishna is not subject to change or transformation. This is the world of transformation. Nothing remains the same in the material world. But rather the spiritual world, everything remains eternally as it is. It is not changing. So, for this reason, we also speak Bhagavad Gita as it is, because it's not changing. Spiritual knowledge is not changing. The truth is not changing. The Supreme Lord is the Supreme Lord. There is never a time that He's not the Supreme Lord. Avajanti bhammura manusim tanamastrita. Fools think that I've assumed this human form. But actually, the Lord is eternally the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all-powerful, all-pervading, present in the heart of all living beings, totally aware of what they think, what they desire, what they do, and so forth. This is the nature of transcendence. Therefore, it is said that there are two ways to approach spirituality. One is described as the ascending process, and the other one is described as the descending process. So the ascending process is that by means of our own intellectual power and by means of our own instruments and systems, we try to uncover reality. So it says this process is bound to fail. The other process is the descending process. So Srimad Bhagavatam is knowledge which comes in the descending process. It is apuruṣeya, or revealed by the Supreme Lord, transcendental knowledge, which the Lord Himself revealed to us, and therefore it is a gift of mercy of the Lord. Right? So, true spiritual understanding depends on mercy. And the devotee can attract the mercy of the Lord. This he can do by his attitude of service and surrender to the Supreme Lord. It is said one's service attitude is the key which will give one spiritual insight. Premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena. If we get bhakti vilochan, or eyes which are transformed by devotional service. Devotional eyes. When we see the world through devotional eyes, the world looks different. Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that when the living entity becomes absorbed in enjoying the senses, then the normal functions of the soul become dormant. And at that stage, the living entity tends to mistake material things for spirit. He thinks that it's spiritual, although it is material. For example, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said the word devotion. We think that devotion can be applied to children have devotion to their parents, or devoted to the nation, devoted to one's work. Right? But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said, no, this is not devotion. Right? Devotion always means service, full, selfless service. Right? There is no egotistic principle, he said, in this. There is nothing like that. Right? So the pure devotion is where everything is for the pleasure of the Lord. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is stated, Admindriya Prithivanchitara Bolikam, Krishnindriya Prithichidare Premanam, that as long as we are interested in satisfying our own senses, our own mind, our own desires, then we are on a material platform. But when we begin to work for the pleasure of Krishna, then, yes, then we come to the spiritual platform.
So, therefore, a person who is concerned with his own interest is judging every situation like that. Is it pleasurable or not for me? But a devotee is looking, is it good for Krishna consciousness, or is it good for Krishna? Then it's nice. Like today, from our perspective, what will be happening in this city is not nice. From our perspective, it's crazy. Right? People are going to have rave parties. People are going to take all kinds of drugs. People are going to get totally drunk, and they're going to throw unlimited junk on the street, and they'll just be grossly intoxicated. So it's in itself not a wonderful thing. Right? It's not a wonderful thing. It's a crazy thing. It's like degraded and mad. But because a devotee can see the opportunity to distribute the mercy of Krishna, he considers this a very nice time, a very favorable moment, a moment that something wonderful can be done. And therefore, we are going out there in the middle of an ocean of black leather. I'm remembering from last year that, you know, we came into the Leidse Straat at one point in the evening time, right? And there was an ocean of black leather everywhere. It's just the whole street, right? And they were on the roof of the tram houses, standing there, you know, everywhere. They were all dressed in black leather. It's just like, my God, you know, what an intense scene here, right? Yes, the Kali Yuga dress, black leather, right? So it was gross, it was degraded. But at the same time, so many people were there and so many heard the holy name that in that way it was something wonderful was also happening. Right? We had, when we left from the museum plane, then what happened was we left with the devotees and I started leading the kirtan and I wasn't looking back until we were already quite some distance. Someone said, look. And behind us were 50 people. They were all wearing green ponchos, right? I'm sure some of you also will remember. There were boys and girls. I don't know what it was. The green ponchos, plastic ponchos, rain ponchos, you know, all of them. And at one point, you know, Bhakti Steve, who's now cutting tomatoes, he was dancing in the front. And some of the girls with the ponchos came in the front. And they made it like... They took their ponchos off and put it all together like that, and then they were moving it around like cheer girls, you know, in an American football game, you know, and they started dancing around Bhakti Steve, who was like having his own Ras Lila here in Amsterdam. And later, in confidence, he told me this was the most difficult moment in my life. Well, we will be seeing amazing things, without a doubt. It is a great opportunity to distribute the mercy of the Lord. This is the idea. This universe, which has been created by the Supreme Lord, is simply an arrangement for the living entities to reside and forget Krishna. If we want to exist somewhere and not remember the Supreme Lord, then we can come to the universe, the material universe. So that's the business here, forgetfulness. But our business is to be the agents of the Lord and somehow or other remind the conditioned souls. So this is austerity. at first, right? In the beginning, when we do this, we feel that heavy, intense, boss, right? As Nanda Kumar used to say. It's tough, but by doing this, gradually we become inspired, and gradually we get taste. Gradually we become purified and begin to experience that giving is greater than taking. That in, as long as we are in Krishna consciousness and thinking, when is it going to happen for me? When will I get it? When will I experience something? Something spiritual, something elevated. As long as we are in this state of consciousness, right, we will always be restless and always be dissatisfied and always be in anxiety. But as soon as we start giving selflessly, giving without considering ourselves, and the more we start giving, the more inspired we will become. And the more close we will feel to Krishna, and the more we will feel that we are getting mercy, although we never ask for it. Right? This is the nature of Krishna consciousness. It is very nice in this way. How simply by giving the mercy we become enlivened. So that is the principle. The principle of the Supreme Lord and the principle of the devotees. We may have some hesitance, you know, to go again another year into this ocean of madness, into this ocean of, as I described, black leather, right? To go into an ocean of black leather bodies that are totally intoxicated and mad, etc. And the weather is also, as they well, totally rotten, right? And it says that in the morning, the temperature is going down. I just looked on the web, right? The temperature is going to go down to 6 degrees, which is, and the wind is going to pick up, right? And it's going to go up to of 7 on the Beaufort scale, and big showers of rain will set in, especially in the west of the country, right? And by the afternoon, it will spread to the whole country, and it will pour buckets, right? So, you know, you're thinking, well, I'm staying home this year. Of course, we're not going to unnecessarily over-endeavor. We'll do what is reasonable. But still, we may have our hesitation, right? We may have our hesitation to go out there in the midst of all that, right? So how much hesitation then should the residents of Vaikuntha have to come to this material world, right? They've got it much better than we do. We are here, we have a reason to go out there, a fruitive one, because by doing it, you know, we earn some stripes to go back to Godhead, right? So, you know, it's in our own interest. It's not all mercy, it's like we got a chance to get a few bonus points today, you know, right? So, but the residents of the spiritual world, they don't have to earn any bonus points at all. They are simply there in the spiritual sky, relishing. So why would they come? Why would they come to this material world? For what reason? The only reason is it because they're desiring it? No, they're not exactly desiring to come to the material world. The material world to them looks absolutely horrible, right? But they are considering that the Supreme Lord can never be fully satisfied if there is one living being separated from service to Him. Right? Therefore, as long as there is still even one living being separated from the Lord, the Lord desires that living being will also go back to Godhead. So, as I mentioned it already yesterday, and I mention it again, is that the devotee, he becomes the servant of the Lord. Therefore, whatever is important to the Lord becomes important to the devotee. And therefore, gradually, the devotee develops the same mentality as the Lord. Right? In the beginning, he's just thinking about what is important for the Lord and trying to remember it, you know. But after some time, it becomes important for him too. And in that way, he becomes like an extension of the Lord and begins to... He is the living instrument of the Lord. And in that way, the devotees of the Lord come from Vaikuntha to the material world to deal with the bewildered spirit souls who have become caricatures of what they really are. Right? Indeed, we will see so many people that appear to us like caricatures when we go out in such a festival and seeing all mad people feasting and partying, right? Caricatures of human existence, right? Of course, to the residents of the spiritual world, we look like caricatures as well. When Narada Muni saw the devotees of Kali Yuga, he was smiling, you know, he's just like, look at this, you know, right? Look at that. And it is a fact, what kind of Vaishnavas, what kind of saintly personalities are we compared to the great saintly personalities, described in Bhagavatam? We can't approach them. They're too exalted. They're so pure and so high. Somehow or another, we are in this process and we don't feel a total transformation as yet. Hasn't happened yet. Right? We are feeling, yes, we are changing, but it's not like that suddenly. And suddenly some of us have become so effulgent that we don't need any more electric light in the room, right? It's not like that yet, right? We may say, well, you look so effulgent, but not that effulgent yet, right? So the results are there, but they are kind of a little subtle, right? A little subtle. They're not total, right? Still, sinful thoughts may appear in our offensive minds, right, from time to time. And what to do? Yes. Then we repent, we try to put it out of the mind, we try to be pure, we try to do service, we chant Hare Krishna, whatever we can, we take shelter of the process. So is there any prospect that this lifetime it will be brought to success? Well, the process is very powerful, but still we see many devotees, even after many years, they still haven't become self-effulgent. So, does one need to be self-effulgent before one can enter into the spiritual sky? Oh yes, Dhruva Maharaj was about to go back to Godhead and a Vaikuntha plane was sent to him. And Dhruva Maharaj, since he was a great devotee, got the mercy of the Lord. And death appeared before him. And Dhruva Maharaj used death as the stepping stone to step into that Vaikuntha plain. And as he was entering, somehow or other, his body had been transformed into a spiritual body. Right? At that point, the residents of the spiritual world, they are totally faultless. Right? There is not a trace of imperfection. So, somehow or other, before we can enter into the spiritual world, this must be there. It is very strict. It is said even devotees who have perfectly behaved in one lifetime take their birth next life in another universe where Krishna appears. It is said that Krishna appears just like the sun. The sun is always moving around in the sky. Now it's here and Later on, it will be in India, and in America, and in Australia. And when it's in other parts of the world, then here the sun doesn't shine, and here it's dark. So the sun is moving around the planet. In the same way, Krishna is moving around the universe. Around the material world, from universe to universe. Now, Krishna is not personally present within this universe, but Krishna travels from universe to universe. So before going back to the spiritual world, it is said that the devotee who has been very sincere takes his birth in that universe to serve Krishna there, to be purified from the last impurities, and then goes back to Godhead. We find these descriptions where it requires high standards of purity before one can enter into the spiritual sky. Fortunately, in this yuga, with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the mercy of the Lord is there to add for special purification, make all kinds of adjustment, and we are praying for it. That somehow or other, whatever we fall short, that the Lord will make up. It is already stated anyway in Bhagavad Gita that Krishna makes up. Ananyas chintayantamam ye jana prayupasate te san nityabhi yuktanam yogakshema vahamiyaham. I carry what you lack and preserve what you have, right? Krishna is stating. So in that way Krishna is already taking care of the devotee. Namo bhakta pranasyati, my devotee will never perish. Krishna is personally making up what we're lacking. So, if Krishna is doing so, and did so, then still we expect more from Lord Chaitanya, because he is the most merciful incarnation. So in that sense, we are hoping that this lifetime will be successful. But our only chance to attract the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is by our spirit of sacrifice. So, the will of the Lord becomes known through the scriptures and through the mouth of the pure devotees. In Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was giving a lecture in Calcutta in front of an assembly of aristocratic Bengali gentlemen. And Srila Bhaktisiddhanta immediately began, and he said the process of pancharatriki, or the pancharatrik process, or the worship of the Archa Vigraha form, or the worship of the form of the deity of the Lord, is certainly an important process in transcendence. However, without desiring to diminish it in any way, right, we must stress that it cannot compare to the propaganda work of spreading Krishna consciousness widely to everyone and anyone. That this, per se, is the process for spreading Krishna consciousness, Harinam Sankirtan. Right. So, how to perform this Harinam Sankirtan? The Harinam Sankirtan is transcendental and acts upon itself. So, we somehow or other simply become absorbed ourselves and drink the taste of chanting. That is the idea. Not that we are going in a mood of pushing ourselves. We're going in the mood of relishing, of tasting the pleasure of chanting, and then we can preach and at the same time immerse in an ocean of pleasure, experience the pleasure. So somehow or other, in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, spiritual life is all austerity. It is based on sense control. It is based on controlling the mind. It is based, therefore, on pushing ourselves in a direction that we don't want to go. And it is an inner struggle and a battle. Right? But as we actually become accustomed, we begin to find where there's taste in Krishna conscious activities. So we just simply try to become absorbed in that aspect, and everything will be very transcendental and pleasurable, without a doubt. The verse is describing, it is in the chapter of Bhagavatam which is called Fundamental Principles of Material Nature. This chapter is giving us a description about how the material universe is created and how it comes into existence. And the way it is described is how it relates to the Supreme Lord. We see that the way the universe is described, that at all times the energies are emanating from the Lord. The Lord again is entering within to the universe. He's entering into every atom. Everywhere, in all stages, the Lord is involved, right? And from this stage of Bhagavatam, it becomes more and more clear that everything goes on by the mercy of the Lord. So, a Vaishnava can only be comfortable in this world if he sees everywhere the certain. And this is Krishna consciousness. That is the purpose of this chapter of Bhagavatam. And once we begin to see the Supreme Lord behind, then we can contemplate that the Supreme Lord is mercy personified. And that therefore, looking at the Supreme Lord means that we see an arrangement of mercy. If we look how the Supreme Lord is behind this universe, it means as a merciful personality who has mercifully arranged everything in such a way that it is favorable for us to bring us to the point of remembrance. So everything is on our side. Everything is in favor of remembrance of the Supreme Lord. So we cannot lose. And we experience this every year in this this kirtan. Are drinking more and more beer, right? At the result are that people become more primitive, right? And that all brakes go loose, and that kind of animalistic tendencies come out, right? In a strong and holler themselves in a powerful way, right? And there's the energy of the alcohol and drugs. So there's a lot of energy out there from all that, as a result, ocean of people. At the same time, we are chanting Hare Krishna. And as we are chanting Hare Krishna, we also feel that our energy is building up. The first mantras are, you know, it gets a little better, right? And after a while, you know, answers, and eventually, we are in such a powerful rhythm of the chanting, and more aloof and beyond everything that happens, and lifted above. And even at one stage, when it comes to the later part of the day, and our voices begin to go, and our hands get cracked, and our fingers are cut, and our hands are cramped from playing different out of the power, the collective power of all that intoxication is scary, right? It's overwhelming. But still, when we look at the faces of the people that see our kirtan party and hear our kirtan party go by, then we see that they're afraid of us, right? They're afraid of us. They're scared, right? Because they see these guys, you know, they have more power than we have. And every year, that way, every year again, it's like the same realization. It's a yagya, and we hope that break all the limits, even the limit of our sanity. That is not required. We beyond. So everyone can decide for himself where his, and such an opportunity to at least distribute some mercy. It will melt our heart. Our hearts are like stone, and because our hearts are like stone, we are always dissatisfied and always in a state of lamentation. So only when that heart begins to melt, then only can we be delivered from our constant companion, lamentation. Right? So it's a great opportunity for us to become free from that predicament. Okay, I'll stop and see if there are any questions, comments, any additions.
You said that the Supreme Personality of Godhead received mercy personified. And I just want to know, in a universe where there is no need of mercy, let's say everyone is completely...
Mercy, what is mercy? In order to relate to your question, let us repeat the question. He says that, like, imagine there is a universe where no one needs any mercy. No one's intoxicated, no one's sinful, no one's degraded. What about that? Right? But, well, so my answer to that is we should first of all understand what mercy is. The mercy of the Lord is that the Lord loves His devotees. He loves all living beings. And that genuine love which the Lord feels, and that genuine desire to see the living being totally happy, that is the mercy of the Lord. And the Lord, the devotee, reciprocates with that love by love of his own, the more that love of the Lord increases. Right? So this goes on in the spiritual world. In this, you have to see, here in the material world, there is some mercy. The mercy of the Lord is here. There's no doubt about it. Because here we are sinful and intoxicated. If we're not intoxicated with beer, then we are intoxicated with pride. But this is the world of being intoxicated, with something. Intoxicated with our own beauty, intoxicated with so many things, right? This is the place for being intoxicated. But, so here is some mercy. But in those places, the spiritual universe, right, where there is no intoxication at all of anything but the Lord, right, there, there's still a need for mercy, right? There, the devotees are hankering even more for the mercy, and there is more mercy there than here. More. Right? Of course, the mercy of the spiritual world, it says, descends to the material world in the form of the Holy Name. Right? So in that way, we also can access the mercy of the spiritual world. But as a whole, right, there's more mercy in the spiritual world than here. Although there is an absence of sinful activity there. Right? And everyone in the spiritual world is also intoxicated. But intoxicated with the desire to serve Krishna. Totally intoxicated with that. And intoxicated with the amazement they experience when Krishna responds to their service. In such amazing ways. You can't believe it. Nobody can believe it. So the mercy of Krishna is even greater there than here. Any other question?
How does one look with devotional eyes?
How does one look with devotional eyes? It is not an intellectual adjustment. One cannot just kind of look for a few screws, that must be somewhere, and if we turn them around, the eyes are on spiritual, and where are the screws, right? It is not like that. Spiritual eyes are given to us, right? We receive them from the representatives of the Supreme Lord. Oma Gyanati Manam Nasya Gyananana Salakya. We get them from the spiritual master. And not just automatically, right? But by serving the spiritual master, by surrendering to the spiritual master. The day we accept a spiritual master, right? The day that we say, yes, from today on I accept a spiritual master, now I want to be your disciple, yes? Then from that day on, we surrender our intelligence and we say, from today on, I will no longer act upon my own intelligence, but I will act upon the superior purified intelligence of my spiritual master. So immediately we are uplifted. Immediately we are disconnected from our karma, because our intelligence was totally covered by lust. Due to our karma or our involvement with the material energy, we are covered up to a certain extent by lust. And our entire body is covered by lust, our mind is covered by lust, our senses are covered by lust, and our intelligence is covered by lust. What is our chance to ever get out of lust? But the superior intelligence of the spiritual master, who is not affected by that lust, immediately when we act upon that intelligence of the spiritual master, we are lifted above that lust. Right? So immediately, we borrow his vision. Yes, and although we don't see clearly yet, but still immediately we begin to see something of the spiritual path, simply because we are seeing, we're trying to see things as he is indicating. Then, as we begin to act according to the vision and instructions that he's giving, then all the impurities from our heart, the papa beach, the sinful seeds in our heart, they will disappear. Prabhupada makes that point that a thief, he is seeing that another man gets caught. He is seeing that all the thieves that he know have a jail sentence, you know, somewhere ahead of them or behind them. And still, he's doing it. Why is he doing it? Because the papa beach, the seed, is burning in his heart. He has to do it. He's compelled to do it. So, in the beginning, when we act on the spiritual master's superior intelligence, it's still difficult. We cannot always see with spiritual eyes, because sometimes we become bewildered, right? The spiritual master says, this is Maya, and we think, she looks damn good, right? So, he says, this is suffering. We say, well, it looks like enjoyment. Yeah. So, in the beginning, our vision is not yet synchronized with the vision that is given to us by the spiritual master. But as we are trying to act upon the superior vision of the spiritual master, sinful seeds disappear and our vision becomes synchronized. And at that stage, we develop this state of premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena santasadevi hida yesu viloka yanti yam shama sundara, etc. We can finally get the darshan of the Supreme Lord at all times and see with bhakti vilochan, with spiritual eyes, like that. So it's not an intellectual adjustment. It comes from serving the spiritual master wholeheartedly. Yes? When someone loses trust in devotees, what does this mean and how to regain it? There can be various reasons for losing trust in devotees. And sometimes it appears that a devotee is being mistreated because he had not himself done anything to provoke a negativity that happened to him. He didn't provoke it, but somehow or other it happened. He was such a sincere person, but his guru fell. Or he was peaceful and gentle, and he was treated with boots and yelled at.
and totally unjustified, mistreated. So sometimes a devotee feels mistreated or feels that it's unjust what is coming to him and feels discouraged and feels that, you know, I cannot tolerate this, right? And he leaves Krishna consciousness. So in this way he can lose trust, lose faith. But at the same time, losing trust and losing faith means also that one didn't have very developed faith. Because when the faith is developed, one will not lose it, right? No matter what happens. Like, the worst thing that can possibly happen is the spiritual master falls down. What is worse than that? Right? That's really, I mean, in terms of faith, you know? I mean, that's pretty bad, right? I mean, there's your example on whom you have your living example, who you fully trusted and you put all your faith. If that person falls down, well, then, you know, that's about the worst thing that can happen to you, to your faith, right? And you get a big blow to your faith. But, you know, even if that happens, you still have Krishna, right? Krishna still exists. And Krishna, he is still the Supreme Lord, and we are still his eternal servant. That cannot change, right? So if one understands this thoroughly, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and I am his eternal servant. Then no matter what happens, you know, even if all hell breaks loose, even if everything collapses, even if the world burns down, still, I'm still Krishna's servant. Even if my spiritual master leaves, even if that would happen, it would be terrible. But I am still Krishna's eternal servant. So now what will change? There's no alternative. I still have to do my duty. Right? So now I have to start looking. I need encouragement. I'm weak. I feel my senses are very strong. My vision is not very clear. I do not have fully developed bhakti vilochan, spiritual eyes. My spiritual master was giving me vision and helping me, and now if I don't get that and I'm all alone with my regular eyes, I may slip on the path like anything and fall prey to Maya. I need association. All right, let me search it out, right? So that I can remain fixed in this platform. Right? So in this way, if the faith has reached to that state that we thoroughly understand Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am his eternal servant, then that faith cannot be shaken. It may be shaken, but cannot be broken. Right? It may be shaken by the circumstances, but can never be broken. Right? So this is so we have to thoroughly understand this principle, that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. But then the doubter says, yes, but how do you know? How do you know really, actually, you know, that Krishna exists? How do you really know? I mean, how can you actually prove it? Okay, you know, like your scriptures, all right, you have all your arguments, but how do you, you have your arguments why God is supposed to exist logically, but you know, have you seen Krishna? Do you actually communicate with Krishna? You yourself, right? Do you really know it?
Well, sometimes someone comes, you know, and somebody new, and he asks this question, well, have you seen Krishna penetrating look in the eyes? You know, like, he said, well, you know, we're seeing Krishna all the time, you know, and we're seeing Krishna in so many things, etc. No, have you seen him right in front of you in his threefold bounded form with the flute and everything? Have you? No, not really. Then, how do you know? Right? So like that, the doubter is like saying, well, you know, how do you really know you are the eternal servant of Krishna? Well, even if you don't know that, right, then the alternative is you may just be a combination of a bunch of chemicals, etc., a plastic bag full of chemicals. Well, if that's what we are, if we are a plastic bag full of chemicals, then there's nothing to lose, right? That argument is given, right? And that even if you think we are a product of the material nature, then don't worry about it. You know, then nothing is lost, right? If we die and if we wither away. So, you know, in that case, we may as well then just serve Krishna anyway, just in case it's all true. Even if we don't know it's true, like the existentialist philosophers, like Sartre, they were atheist philosophers. But they were intelligent. So they had figured out that, like, well, since in their mind there was no God, then there was no purpose of existence, right? It was all absurd, there was no real purpose to existence. And that was their point. You know, it's like, if you don't have God, then there's no purpose to existence. But still, you would say to such an existentialist philosopher that, like, well, all right, but look, you know, you don't know for sure that God doesn't exist. He might. And you would have to say, well, yeah, he might, but we also don't know that he does. You say, fine. But since life is absurd, you know, and it could just be true that God does exist, you may as well serve him, just in case. And if he doesn't exist, nothing lost, because everything is absurd anyway and senseless anyway. So then you haven't lost anything by dedicating your life to Krishna. But if it's true, then you get all the benefits. So therefore, even if you're a doubter, the position of service to Krishna is still the best, even for the doubter. The doubter is doing it and keeps on doing it, just in case. Just in case.
Huh? His argument should be turned against himself.
Well, he should do it just in case. It's true. You know? I mean, like, nothing else makes sense. There's nothing else, if nothing else makes sense in the material world, because it's all temporary and temporary benefit, and you can't be really happy anyway, no matter how you try, you know, can't get no satisfaction and all that, then, you know, there's no point in trying for all that. You know, you'll see all those people, they'll be trying today like crazy, and they're not gonna have any real satisfaction. Right? Only gonna have a big hangover. So, you know, even, just in case, we serve Krishna. So if there's a problem with faith, we do it like that. Thanks. So what do you think? I get a flower for that. Is it?
Flower means surrender.
I see. Flower means also appreciation. Demigods shower flowers. And flower means you like the answer? You're satisfied? Thank you very much.
Kuranga. So how are you supposed to communicate while chanting? Because it seems that
to communicate while chanting. You're supposed to communicate from the tongue to the mouth. From the tongue to the ears. Right? That's how you're supposed to communicate. In a straight line. So you produce the sound clearly, the tongue and the lips. You know? Hare Krishna. Throat is involved. And then you're supposed to communicate it directly to the ears. Next question.
But you explained that to get devotional eyes, there's no intellect for just being it. But then you explained that once you serve intelligence, so to me that seems like the biggest intellect for just being
it. That depends on the nature of the person, where his energy is. Different people are focused in different ways. Some are on the sensual platform, some are on the mental platform, some are on the intellectual platform, and some are on the spiritual platform. So those who are on the sensual platform, for them it will be the biggest thing to get off the sensual platform, to control the senses. Those who are on the intellectual platform will have a big inner battle, you know, to come to the point to surrender their intelligence to someone else. Someone who's very much on the sensual platform may just instinctively, you know, like feel, yes, this person is the one, and just like on the basis of feeling, just surrender your intelligence. And it doesn't take any reasoning and any arguments. And someone who's then on the intellectual platform is looking at such a person thinking, how is it possible? How can they just possibly surrender like that without asking any questions and without, like, you know, any any queries or any arguments. I mean, you know, how can they give themselves so cheaply, so lightly, you know, like, you know, so it depends where one places its energy. When the energy of the soul becomes dormant because we are becoming involved with egotistic identification, then that egotistic, that egotism goes either into the sensual, into the senses, or it goes into the mind, and so wherever it is, you know, wherever we've directed it, that's so it will be a little different from case to case, I think, where the battle will be fought most. Of course, nobody has his energy exclusively on the intellectual platform, right? It's always mixed, but there is something is predominant, right? So, like that. But therefore, even the intellectual experiences sensual pleasure, right? And mental pleasure and all that, you know. Any other? Okay, well, let's get a few hours left, so let's use them nicely, and then we're leaving at 11 o'clock. So, real time. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.